Hello, my friends. It is Detective Ev here. I wanted to let you know before we started this episode today about our famous 5 and 5 workshop that is going live for the third time ever, March 18th of 2024. If you're like, Detective Ev, what the heck is a 5 and 5 workshop? It is the best resource we have ever created to show someone what FDN is before they actually pay the tuition to do it. So what I mean by that is you get to spend 5 days with us, not the whole day. We're about an hour to an hour and a half live every single day, and we do give you the recordings if you can't make one or all of the days. But we're going to go live with you for 5 days straight, Monday through Friday. I will be hosting each session, but it's not just going to be me. I'm really taking a back seat in this kind of situation. We are going to be letting you get access to our clinical advisors and course mentors as they go through a live case study together. So all 5 days are us just working on one case together, going over live lab results. We're doing screen shares so that you can see it. You're learning about different markers and the protocols that we do. So are you going to be able to take all the information from this workshop and then go out and run an FDN practice? Of course not. But what you're able to do from this is, one, you're going to get some useful information for sure. If you never end up doing FDN, you're definitely going to be able to take something from this and apply it to your own health coaching practice. However, if you're considering the FDN course and you go through this, you're either going to like it or you're not going to like it. And if you like it, then the FDN course is a great fit for you. It's just a matter of figuring out when would be a good time for you to pursue it. If you do not resonate with it for whatever reason, or maybe somehow you felt like you already knew the information, then in that case, I would consider FDN not a good fit. So it's much better to spend the money on this workshop than it is to spend all that money on tuition if it's not even something that you wanted to do. Now, normally the workshop is $99, but for our podcast listeners before March 18th, it is $33. So just go down to the show notes and you're going to see a link for fdntraining.com/5and5March2024. That's fdntraining.com/5and5March2024. And that is in the show notes. I'm looking forward to seeing you guys there. Now let's get to today's episode. Hello and welcome to the Health Detective Podcast by Functional Diagnostic Nutrition. We bring you interviews from people who have conquered the trickiest of health challenges using the Functional Diagnostic Nutrition philosophy and similar healing modalities. You're going to hear from experts who have been through the ringer with their health issues and yet managed to come out on the other side. If you're interested in natural healing and/or functional medicine, congrats, you are in the right place. You can always visit us at functionaldiagnosticnutrition.com, but for now, here is today's episode. All right. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the Health Detective Podcast by Functional Diagnostic Nutrition. My name is Evan Transu, aka Detective Ev, and I will be your host for today's show, episode number 311 of the Health Detective Podcast. It's going down on a Friday afternoon. I always love these because we actually get a good amount of you guys tuning in. You're all fellow health nerds like us, and this is what we consider a recreational Friday activity to get the weekend started right, learning about EMFs. All right. If you guys do not know yet, by the way, I should have shouted this out last time. This is completely off the topic of EMFs, but we have one of our coolest workshops coming up in the middle of March here. It starts March 18th. It's called our 5 and 5 lab workshop. We have done this only twice live in the past. It's super well attended. It's kind of probably the best resource that we have if you're considering the FDN course. So we go over all five labs, the foundational labs, that is, that we teach in the FDN course over 5 days. So if you sign up for it, you'll actually be live with us Monday for an hour and a half, Tuesday for an hour and a half, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. We have different clinical advisors from FDN hopping on, different mentors. And if somehow you do not hear enough of me, then I will be on there as well. I'll be co-hosting for those people and just extracting all the great information out of them. We also go over live test results. So these are Zoom calls that you'd want to hop on. You get to watch us do live lab analysis. If you're interested in that, check the show notes on YouTube after this podcast is live. I'll update it in just a few minutes afterwards. And if you're listening on audio, it will already be in the show notes for you. Today, we are talking to Nick, the EMF guy, Pino, like the wine. And this bio saved me here, Nick, because I was like, all right, I'm totally going to mess up this last name.
Perfect.
Is the number one best-selling author of The Non-Tinfoil Guide to EMFs and an advocate for safe technologies. Through his unconventional approach, blending humor, science, and common sense, he's becoming a leading voice on the topic of electromagnetic pollution and how it affects our health. For the last few years, Nick has been interviewing some of the best minds on health and technology and facilitating the creation of courses and educational materials to raise awareness on this very important issue. You can find more about Nick at theemfguy.com. Nick, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. It's a pleasure.
Yeah. So when did you publish that book, by the way?
2017.
Okay. Yep. I heard about you years ago. So this is actually kind of awesome that this has come in full circle. I might have heard about you before we even started this podcast in, what was that, 2021. So really cool to have you on today. With that said, I got to ask, how the heck did you get into this? Because this is normally a subtopic that people in the functional medicine space might be into. So, you know, someone like me, if I'm working with clients, I'll mention this to them at almost a surface level because my understanding of it might not be as deep. But to say, hey, this normally a subtopic is what I'm going to make my passion and my work. I am so curious about what got you interested in this.
Yeah, it's a long story. To make it short, you know, I'm a citizen journalist. I started writing about nutrition around 2010, and I quickly discovered that I had a passion for things that aren't popular to talk about. You know, aren't necessarily the sexiest topics, such as environmental toxins. At the time, a lot of people were into getting into the paleo diet and these kind of things. And my point was, well, our ingredients aren't really paleo, are there? Because they also contain certain toxins such as pesticides or herbicides such as glyphosate, for example, that is often talked about, that will disrupt our health to one way or another. So we have to take into account these exposures and also discover things like, well, tap water is often contaminated with whether it's copper or lead or traces of pharmaceutical drugs, and these exposures are not properly regulated. And I found the same thing with cell phone radiation and also other types of man-made EMFs such as Wi-Fi or Bluetooth when I read several books on the topic that were each authored by very credible scientists. And in my mind, before starting to get into EMFs, EMFs was really this topic that is a little bit fringe. And, you know, a lot of people that talk about it aren't very serious. And I found the exact opposite in my research and realized, my God, there are very, very credible scientists at the time. The late Dr. Martin Blank from Columbia. There was Dr. Deborah Davis, who has been a co-Nobel laureate for work around the environment. And many of these scientists were actually award-winning and very recognized for their work in other areas of pollution. One of them, Dr. Magda Havis, successfully help push legislation to protect the environment against certain polluters that were very the root cause of acid rain in Canada. So now she got into EMFs and she really uncovered that, my God, we're not regulating all of these exposures in a proper way to protect the public and the environment. So it got me thinking, well, in a sense, EMFs is one of the worst environmental toxins out there, because not only is it increasing, whereas other environmental toxicities are hopefully decreasing because we know we should decrease how much we pollute the planet. I think by now most people know that, although it's not always done. But not only is it fastly increasing, there's also this skepticism towards any EMF science. Some people have even told me, and that's not the best example of a great exchange in Facebook comments or Instagram, but some people told me, Nick, there's not one single study showing harm. They told me that. And I said, my God, if that's the belief, it really means the person has spent 0 minutes on PubMed, because in reality, there are literally thousands of studies that have been done on EMFs, and some of them are inconclusive, of course. Some of them show negative effects, and some of them, you know, neutral or positive effects. So yes, it's a mixed literature, but the reality is that there's enough scientific evidence to have these prestigious scientists such as Dr. Martin Blank at Columbia back in the days to say we should urgently look at our EMF safety standards and rethink how much we are using these EMFs. And since then, the opposite has been done. We're using more and more and more EMFs and closer to our bodies than ever before, which is why I continued in this line of research, because it's not getting better. But I'm trying through awareness to bring this topic to the forefront. And hopefully with this broadcast, we're also, you know, raising a few eyebrows and getting some good debates going.
Yeah. And so to be clear, then, did you have any like major health issues while getting into this? Or was it truly just, hey, I'm trying to find things that are interesting. I want to find things that maybe other people won't, they're not willing to venture into. Like, did you have any health issues going on?
Well, not a lot, except the part where, as a health author, I was killing myself by burning the candles at both ends, as a lot of internet entrepreneurs get at first. So I did have a health crisis of my own, but as far as EMFs go, I did realize that I was more sensitive than I at first thought when I wrote my book, and I wrote my book on a wireless keyboard. You know, and in the book, I say, I'm writing this on a wireless keyboard. Is this safe? I wasn't really sure. And after writing my book, I sold my keyboard, I sold my wireless mouse, and I started hardwiring my computer with an Ethernet cable to lower my exposure. And then I realized I feel clearer now. And when I work on Wi-Fi, I feel more foggy. So for me, it was really cognition. And I felt like this veil had been lifted if I stopped working on Wi-Fi. These days, my health is in a much better place. And I did follow an approach that is, I think, very similar to what FDN is following with a health practitioner. And I got tested, you know, organic acids really helped me, stool testing. And as I improved my health and knocked some of the underlying causes of fatigue and acne and different everyday symptoms that I had, I felt less and less sensitive to EMFs. So in a sense, I did realize myself that when you're already inflamed or already your nervous system is already very sensitive to a lot of things that are going on in the environment, you tend to be very... you could be more sensitive to EMFs. And that's the case for a lot of people, I think.
I totally agree with that. I've experienced that anecdotally myself. I remember when I was still in the midst of my health journey, I went down to Miami for work for like 3 weeks at one point. And I was coming from suburbs, you know, one Wi-Fi router where I was at, like on the phone, if you try to connect to Miami, like in the city, whatever. And I was doing the exact same things in Miami that I did up here. Same diet, same sleep schedule, but I started breaking out. I started feeling the fatigue is what got me the most. That I noticed was totally off for me. Now, with this all said, this topic of EMFs, I do find it fascinating because it's one of the more, I'll word it this way. You do have very intelligent, well-read people that are publishing stuff on this, and they are talking about this. And I don't mean this in a political sense. It's not a political show, but I always find it hilarious how there is a group in America, at least, that preaches, follow the science, trust the scientists. If you're not a scientist, shut up. And okay, let's say that that's accurate. What's funny is they don't mean that. What they mean is follow what the media tells me is the latest science or latest news, and that's what I'll follow. Because there are a lot of scientists that disagree with what's put on mainstream media. Now, I'm not saying that automatically makes them right. I really try to be an objective person and think through all sides. But I'm like, you say follow the science, but you don't follow the science at all. If everyone followed the science, we'd all be getting out of artificial light at night. That is so clear that that affects our health negatively. That is not disputable anymore. And yet every single person yelling at me saying follow the science will be on their phone doing so at, you know, 1 a.m. while they're not getting any sleep. So it's not really follow the science. It's follow what media told me is something I need to follow. So with that said, when we're talking about EMFs, I think we should specify we're talking about non-native electromagnetic frequencies, because electromagnetic frequencies are not inherently bad. The sun is part of the light spectrum. There's a bunch of nuance here. So what do you think is some of the biggest issues in terms of the non-native EMFs? Because, you know, we are overwhelmed now. We got 1,000 routers if you're in the city, all hitting at once. I'm under tech right now. I have this computer screen. Now, I might turn this off later, but I'm still using it. People are walking around with cell phones, so I don't even know if it can be narrowed down to one, but I'm curious what you think is like one of the biggest things that's hurting all of us.
Yeah, it is. It is all cumulative. And scientists say, you know, it's hard to pinpoint what is the most dangerous source of EMS, but it would have to be the sources that are closest to your body because of the potential risks associated with, you know, increases in cancer, especially cancer of the head. And the data on this is mixed. Some people say, you know, there's no real risk. It's just a class 2B carcinogen. Yeah, well, it's and they say things like, oh, pickle juice is a class 2B carcinogen. Okay, yeah, but you've also got very serious harmful substances in the class 2B. So we can play both sides here. However, the data since that decision in 2011 shows that we should reclassify this agent called radio frequency radiation, the same EMFs emitted by a phone or Wi-Fi or Bluetooth, as a class 1 carcinogen because we have the animal data now. And this has been sitting on shelves since 2018, and scientists have been saying, look, we have enough data to reclassify right now, but it has to go through the International Agency for Research on Cancer, and there's a lot of politics involved, and there's a strong lobbying power that is against these decisions because, of course, do you think it's bad for business to say that cell phones are in the same category as asbestos and smoking? Of course. The day this is going to pass, it will be undeniable that cell phones are harmful to some degree or another. So, that being said, if I had to pick one use that is the most dangerous that you can have in your life with a phone, it would be to talk on the phone on your ear. But the thing is, these days, most people, I would say, especially young people, stop doing that anyway. So that's a good thing. They use, you know, earbuds and they use texting and they scroll internet, social media. But they've started, instead of using a phone on the head, they now use Bluetooth earbuds. And the data we have on this is next to none. There are barely any studies on Bluetooth because it's such a new technology. And people will listen to this and say, well, I mean, Bluetooth has been around for a while. Yes, but, you know, the largest studies we have on EMF dangers were rats and mice exposed for long term, so up to several months, to 2G and 3G cellular telecommunication technology. This is old stuff, you know. So our ability to study EMFs and man-made EMFs and these new technologies is greatly surpassed, is overwhelmed by our ability to come up with new exciting devices. And that's part of the problem. Scientists are saying we should put a moratorium on 5G. We should not roll out these additional technologies because the data we already have shows harm. And that was on technology used 10, 15, 20 years ago. So it's really, you know, the presumption that the industry uses is that everything before was safe, therefore all future technologies will be safe. But what scientists are saying is that, well, these assumptions were completely wrong, so therefore everything before was dangerous, and therefore everything in the future will also be dangerous and not safe. Yes. So our safety standards need to completely be rehauled, and urgently so.
Well, and this is kind of a general theme that we do. It seems like with certain food ingredients, like the additives that we have and the technology, it's more like, let's just throw it out there. Then we'll see what happens. And then if people start complaining enough, we'll start studying it. Oh, sorry, we messed up. This is what happened with smoking, right? This is what's happening with the artificial sweeteners. We're like, yeah, this is probably good. Why don't millions of you try this stuff first? And then we'll see what actually happens. Like, oh my goodness, it's a crazy way to do these things. But there's big money behind this stuff. It's a huge push. I mean, the irony of what we're talking about, to at least some degree, is we couldn't even share this damn information if it wasn't for these non-native electromagnetic frequencies that we're using. We're sitting here on a podcast doing this, you know, from miles and miles and miles away, countries away, actually. So it's kind of funny. Now, you mentioned the word cumulative. It has this cumulative effect. And I think this is where people, including myself, get very confused around the EMF thing. Because here's an argument. I forget who posed this to me one time. It might have even been myself, because I'll try to argue myself in my head. I don't know. But I think it's a reasonable enough point. you could take someone in rural America, and we know that cancer rates are less out there, but you still can get cancer being in rural America where you might have no cell signal. Okay. Then you go to the opposite extreme. Again, let's go to Miami. Let's say I have thousands of Wi-Fi routers around me. Well, if EMF was so dangerous, then how are people not just dropping dead from being exposed to all these things at once? So it does seem to have this cumulative effect that, like, hey, it might make you feel bad initially, but in terms of a cancer or another disease, like a real disease state, that might take longer. So are there differences then between the short-term exposure effects versus the long-term exposure effects from what you've researched and seen?
For sure. The lag between exposures and the development of brain cancer can be decades. Mm-hmm. So really, the big concern is what could happen decades from now from the exposures that we're doing now. And we already have seen increases in one cancer type in particular, the glioblastomas. And we have recent data from the UK confirming this. And it looks more and more and more that in the Western world, we can directly see a correlation with the advent of the cell phone and glioblastomas. So, and it's an exposure where the glioblastomas and the tumor types are ipsilateral, so same side where people talked on the phone. Mm-hmm. So it is another, you know, another check mark of causality there. And, you know, let's look at the courts. Well, there are hundreds of different claims that my cell phone gave me a brain tumor, and more attorneys are now winning these cases. So at least the courts think that causality has been established in these cases because they're paying out people. So that's one thing, but this is cancer. And I'm not personally, I wrote a newsletter lately posing the question to my community, Is this cancer claim or the uncertainty around cancer kind of hindering the efforts for EMF activists? And it might be, because in the end, I'm not just interested in avoiding cancer. I'm also interested in the general health of the population. And what does that mean? Is health the absence of a chronic disease or an absence of a brain tumor? Or is it, you know, wellness, everyday wellness? And in that sense, we have many other things we could be talking about besides cancer. For example, do EMFs from your phone disrupt brain waves and therefore disrupt your sleep architecture? And researchers looked at this probably before 2008, but in 2008, there were a few good studies of provocation in healthy volunteers. They exposed them to an old Nokia phone. Again, old technology. So we don't know if the new stuff that is, you know, more powerful and more complicated is even stronger. It probably is. So an old Nokia phone for 30 minutes of exposure, and then they had a group with sham exposure where there's no signal. And they found that, yes, it will change your brain architecture and will cause what's called cell phone insomnia, cell phone induced insomnia. So the sleep onset delay was 1 hour more than the group with sham exposure. So in other words, they couldn't fall asleep for an hour after being exposed for 30 minutes. And the researcher said this. They said, well, you know, we cannot really conclude that cell phones are dangerous in that sense, because the arousal effect of the phone is just the equivalent of half a cup of coffee. Hmm. That's what they said. So researchers themselves have a big bias that they don't want to say that cell phones are dangerous, because that's something that will almost end their career, because it's so wild. It's so like tinfoil hatter stuff. But in reality, do you think, and I mean, if people are either interested in the FDN or FDN practitioners, of course, half a cup of coffee is a big deal. It might have even more effect on the first person, and then maybe the fifth person also has an effect, but the eighth person does not. So there will be individual susceptibility to this arousal also, which they didn't talk about. So maybe for some people, their cell phone is literally causing insomnia for them, direct causality. And yet authorities continue to say, well, you know, cell phones are perfectly, perfectly safe. Well, what does safety mean in that sense? Is it avoiding cancer, or is it, I'm not even aware that my phone could be disrupting my sleep? And since then, there has been multiple studies showing that, yes, the cell phones will change brainwaves, even though this is technically, you know, a low-level radiation signal. And to this day, we don't have a warning when we buy this brand new iPhone 15, you know, spanking new, it looks good. And it doesn't say warning, turn off at night or else your sleep might be disrupted because it displaces your brainwave and increases your alpha activity. It doesn't say anything like that. And the industry has been fighting tooth and nail to not have any warning whatsoever at the point of sale. And they won in court in California, got those warnings removed in the city of Berkeley, in fact. So the pushback from the industry is tremendous. They do not want users to fear their phone. And they say, they even cite, you know, oh, this is the I think it's the First Amendment. Like, it's you shouldn't, you know, you will make people paranoid about their phone, and therefore it's a lie. And they argue on, and they win so far. So it's a shame that users are not told that their phone will or might, you know, just be something that goes against their wellness. And it's not, I mean, it's not a very dangerous effect to have an arousal effect, half a cup of coffee, but is it a negative presence in your life? It probably is. And at least if you knew about it, just like most people these days, at least they know about blue light. Doesn't mean they do anything about it, but at least it's in the discussion. Most people think the phone signal just will go through their body, and the body will say, I don't see anything. I don't have any way to detect this signal. So it's completely safe, completely, you know, it's not an issue. And this is not the case. This is really what personally angers me the most, is when I see these kind of statements by scientists that say, oh, no, it's not a big deal. It is, because the population is not healthy, and people aren't necessarily sleeping for long enough and for a good enough quality.
Right. And I'm really big on like informed decisions. One of the words or phrases I always use is I want to level the playing field around health. And leveling the playing field for me means for people to have all the information, all the options, and then they have free will. They should be able to do what they want. If you have Hashimoto's thyroiditis and you want to take synthetic thyroid hormone, I think you have the right to do that. I would never take that from you. However, I also think you should be aware that, hey, when we get people off gluten and do all these other things for them, the FDN style, there are many people, I'm not making a claim, I'm just, these are real stories that have happened on the show. There are many people that have claimed to be in remission after going through lifestyle protocols for Hashimoto's. I think people should be able to choose by having the knowledge of these, but that's not what they get, right? They get one-sided opinions on this stuff. And the money, again, going behind this and just fighting for the ignorance, right? They want public ignorance about this stuff so that people can't be outraged. And then the isolated people that really fight for us, they're trying to do the good work, you know, they'll just get labeled as crazy or tinfoil hat. So your title of your book is actually very funny, right? Like the non-tinfoil hat guide. I love that. Okay. So I real quick question, just kind of curiosity, sure. Because I cannot reference a bunch of studies regarding EMFs. I've looked at them before, but I don't want to misspeak on things. And I might already be treading that water with this one. Are you familiar with, I know I looked back at this at least 5 years ago, so it's at least 5 years old, but it was a meta-analysis that showed both in humans and other mammals that around like 50 to 60 hertz, those frequencies can reduce melatonin production from the pineal gland. Have you heard of that one? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there are several studies around melatonin production. So one of the theories is that the pineal gland maybe is able to perceive not only the light at certain frequencies that are visible, but also invisible. Who knows? That might be the case. And this is really where a lot of people are in disbelief, but our eyes just pick up a very small sliver of the electromagnetic spectrum. Other species can pick up other types of signal, but also we do know now that even humans can pick up certain signals from the environment, just like birds can through the use of magnetite. And it's very special because there's a sense of geolocation in your brain about your presence on this earth. And maybe even it explains why some people are able to find their way and find the north even without, you know, I don't know, but it's interesting to see that we do have electromagnetic senses. And the more we look for them, I think the more science finds them. So even that science is emerging, which is, Again, it's a big problem. How can we know that our uses are of devices is safe when our bodies are bioelectrical and we have yet to discover all aspects of these bioelectric sensors and processes? So how can we know that we're not causing electromagnetic biointerference? The truth is that we're barely scratching the surface on understanding these things. And a few researchers that have looked into it, such as Robert Obecker with the book The Body Electric and Cross Currents, well, some people say that he was, you know, a pioneer in discovering, for example, that how salamanders and certain species can regrow limbs through the use of certain types of electricity that is raising, and also how wound healing is occurring by increasing voltage in certain parts of the body. And it's all fascinating research. And he claimed that the new health threat of the 21st century would be electro pollution. And that's a direct quote from him. So he was not a very popular scientist because, of course, when you study bioelectricity, you're kind of a renegade in that sense. But these people do understand that if you play around with electricity the way we've been doing, including the 50-60 hertz, we're playing with fire. And the 50-60 hertz is a different animal because, of course, we're talking about the electricity that runs in the walls. So what can you do about this one? Well, in building biology, which is, you know, a discipline of making healthier buildings, they include the discipline of EMF mitigation. And there are ways to minimize our exposure to electricity overall, because the electricity should really stay in the wires. That's how electricity should be. And this is the case in most commercial buildings where you see ironclad wiring, this wiring that is made out of metal. It doesn't leak. You don't have a field that goes out of this metal clad wiring. However, in most homes these days, you have cheaper standards where they use Romex. This is plastic wiring. It's not shielded. And therefore, the electric field goes out 6 to 8 feet from every wire, exposing people to very low levels of electricity that are below our level of perception. But scientists argue, well, it's still having an effect. Even if it's little, it turns out that when you minimize these stressors, you go back to a more natural environment. Right, I talked about the paleo diet. One of my arguments with EMS was, well, our EMF diet is far from being paleo, guys, because we're exposed to all of these signals that it's not even our ancestors. It's, you know, our grandparents were not exposed to this stuff. And our grandparents were barely exposed to electricity in most cases. So these are new exposures that our biology simply has not evolved with. This is brand new stuff.
Right. Okay. So I was interested in that one only because I feel like that's another example of this possible cumulative effect here. If I, you know, slightly reduce someone's melatonin over, you know, one night, I mean, who cares? Not a big deal. Just like the half a cup of coffee, who cares? You can recover from that. But if I do that, not only over a couple days, weeks, but actually your lifetime, like if someone is born today, now they're going to be in the crib and they got like a monitor on top of them so that the parents can watch and hear what they're doing in the other room. Right. So, and it, like you said, the 50, 60 hertz, that's everywhere in your household. That's just something that you'd be exposed to all the time. So what happens when we affect one of the body's most powerful antioxidants, most powerful sleep hormones, and then we add more stress than ever before with the foods, with the environmental toxins, with all this stuff? Basically, what you've done is you've added a higher load of stress and you've reduced our ability to handle that stress and recover from that stress, actually would be a better way to say it. So will you get someone sick overnight? Probably not. And then it makes this unfortunately, really amazing argument for these corporations that are just pushing, because it's like, it's so hard to point to, look at what this is doing. Because for some person, it might take 30 years. For some, it might take 5. It also depends on your genetics. What else do you have going on? Were you eating really well under those EMFs? So it's so easy to just like kind of get you going in circles. And then they continue to push out, you know, iPhone 35 or whatever the hell it's going to be, you know, next year. So
for sure, it's hard to pinpoint, you know, one exposure to one symptom or one exposure to one thing. There are a few examples, and this is, I think, among the most compelling examples of the science is clear and definitive, that should make us really go, my God, our EMF science is broken. We need to completely and urgently redefine the EMF safety guidelines and probably redefine how we use devices, or force Apple and Samsung and, you know, all these cell phone manufacturers to re-engineer their machines, because it could be done. And that's another argument that eventually the industry will be forced to change these machines and how much they emit, where they emit, because believe it or not, the patents to shield the antenna so that the user is not exposed on a phone call have been shelved in the 80s by Nokia. These patents are still, you know, not used. Why were they shelved? Well, let's look at it this way. The EMF safety standards are so permissive that you don't need to shield the user against this radiation. And if the engineers are not being told, let's minimize exposure just to be on the safe side, they're going to go, you know, well, okay, we're not going to include this $15 piece of shielding material to shield the antenna against the radiation going towards the user. Instead, we're just going to have an antenna that can pick up or emit 360 degrees or whatever the angle is. So it's not useful to the industry. It's not a requirement. If it were, they would probably do better. But one example I wanted to cite is a cell phone in the pocket, and then the correlation we have to lower fertility in men and even lower testosterone. The data is very, very strong. And in fact, there's been many good studies just in the last 5 years about that. And I'm, to this day, I'm still shocked. I guess I shouldn't be shocked because I've been doing this work for 8 years now. But geez, there's so much good data on the fact that if men have a phone in the pocket for hours every day, you're going to have a lower fertility. That plus the fact that a lot of men are struggling with their fertility, and a lot of healthy couples cannot conceive without the help of medical interventions, it should make us go, well, maybe we should tell them, or maybe we should force Apple that when the phone is touching your body, it turns off. Something like that. I mean, it could be engineered fairly quickly where with a patch, with an update, it could be done. And yet, to this day, most people have a phone in the pocket, and most people are vastly unaware that this correlation exists and are suffering as a result. And that's just fertility. And of course, there might be a whole downstream effect on hormonal production at all level if you're, you know, blasting your genitalia with this radiation, and the real long-term effects are completely up in the air. We have no idea.
What I want to do now, sorry, we just get one comment. Okay, they should see us canaries that are very much affected, but most of us have to leave the devices and internet, so we have no voice. Yeah, that's kind of the problem with this, Tanya. Thanks for the comment. And by the way, if you guys are on, you're more than welcome to comment, ask questions as we finish up the last like 20 minutes here. But that's kind of the inherent issue with all this, right? You need people to be educated enough that actually give a damn, that want to go fight this. And what's sad, and I'm not condemning these people, but I don't know, man. I have a big mouth. Like, when I know something's wrong, when I see an injustice, I want to go do it. Clearly, you're living that way as well, yeah. Nick. There's a fraction of people, you can show them this, and they believe you. They see it. No, I get that. Ev, I'm not going to worry about that, though. Nick, come on, man. I got bigger things to worry about. So it's like, one, you need to educate people, and two, you need to hope to God that the people that you're educating actually care enough to say, you know, that's wrong. I don't like the way that this is going. I'm going to do something about it. And the funniest part is this is like all of history, right? It's basically waking up the masses. There's a select few that kind of go and fight the good fight. And, you know, we hope for the best. And thank God we're here because of them to this day. We've probably scared the crap out of people by now, Nick, which is good. We got them paying attention. I want to extract some information from you as to what we can do. There's so many things you've alluded to so far, hardwiring, building biologists, lots of different stuff. So how does Nick, the EMF guy, live now? Because you still have the benefits of doing podcasts like this or other media things. So it's not like you're living under a rock. You're not suggesting that to people. Yeah. We are mitigating here. So what are the first steps?
Yeah, you know, in my course, I use something called the 3D system. It stands for downtime, distance, and duration. So the first downtime, why is it? It looks like there's a circadian effect to EMFs, just like with visible light. So make sure to mitigate first your bedroom, where you sleep. So even if you don't care of you don't take care of your daytime exposure, if you take care of your nighttime exposures, at least you might ameliorate your sleep. So I think this is critical. So for example, turning off your cell phone altogether or hitting that airplane mode button. It's not just when you board the airplane. You can in fact, you know, use it to minimize radiation in at night. And also, if people expect a call or they have teenage kids and they say, no, no, Nick, my phone will be open tonight because in case of emergency, I don't even have a landline anymore. That's the case for most people. Keep it, charge it in the next room, in the bathroom, charge it on the kitchen table and put the ringer with the sound of maximum. You'll hear it if someone wants to call you in the middle of the night. And then you can make it like do not disturb, except if certain numbers call me or certain contacts. You can all set it in a way that, you know, is just for emergencies. So that's first. And I would also consider turning off the Wi-Fi router, which a lot of people report gives them better sleep. So that's downtime. Then distance is just, as I mentioned, the biggest risks are when the devices are touching you. So I'm not a fan of using Bluetooth anything in the ear. If it's a Bluetooth sensor, some people ask me, especially personal trainers or athletes, I use a Bluetooth heart monitor. Is it, you know, is it a big problem? I use a Bluetooth watch. You know, if it's a few hours per week, it's less of a concern compared to something you would wear 12 hours per day. So it's all a matter also of duration, which is the third, but the distance part is really don't use many devices that are touching your body because it's really down the road you might have cancer risks. And this is really, you know, life-threatening situations here in many cases. And the third one is duration. A lot of people ask me, you know, Nick, I just listened to your podcast. I have this toaster and they start telling me all about their toaster in a DM and they say there's a Bluetooth sign on there. I think is blasting me with EMFs. So I say, yes, okay. Maybe your toaster is a, you know, smart technology and is emitting Wi-Fi. It's not ideal, but how much time are you spending with your face on the toaster? And they say, well, essentially 0 minutes per day. Okay, well, therefore don't spend time there. Duration, where are you spending your time? Bedroom, maybe kitchen table, 1 hour, 2 hours per day, maybe your favorite sofa, maybe it's a 3 hour in the evening. Okay, these are good places to start, but also your workstation. Maybe we're talking about 8 hours, 10 hours per day that you're spending there. So this is why I do these podcasts from a wired computer. I talked about an Ethernet cable that can connect your router to your computer. That's way preferable compared to Wi-Fi because the Wi-Fi router is emitting radiation and mine is a non-Wi-Fi. I turned off the Wi-Fi antenna, but if it were on Wi-Fi, it would be far away from me, but the computer is close to me. And that's the biggest exposure. The computer is talking back and forth with the Wi-Fi router and the computer is right in front of me. So therefore it's exposing my entire body to a lot of radiation 10 hours per week. If I mitigate this machine, I don't have any exposure anymore. I turn off the Wi-Fi on my computer, I wire it in, then I'm doing great. And over time, I'm really, you know, it's a tremendous amount of radiation that I'm not having. So if occasionally I work on Wi-Fi because I'm away from home, well, I've built the resistance or the resilience to be able to handle more. So it's really, you know, it's the dose over time that makes the poison. So the cumulative dose that we talked about. So it's really going through downtime, your bedroom, and distance, making sure that no device is touching your body if possible. Put it on airplane mode, your phone or other devices if they're in your pocket. Or, you know, even if you're just carrying it for a few minutes, it's not a big deal. But if it's all day, every day with the phone in the pocket, I see a lot of men, they work in an office, their phone is in the pocket. There's no reason to do this. If you put it in front of you on your desk, you're doing great. You're literally reducing the amount of radiation that your groin area would have been exposed to by 95%. That's how powerful the distance is. And then finally, the duration matters because, again, people tend to think about, oh, what about this vacation or what about this occasional exposure? It's not your top priority. It's really what you do on a long-term basis in the places where you actually spend time and with the devices that you actually use. So really, to avoid being overwhelmed, if you follow a system like this, starting with the bedroom, if you forget everything about this interview and just mitigate your bedtime routine, you're already starting in the right spot. And then, of course, you can always go deeper and hire a building biologist. That's a good step if you want to mitigate your environment, or if you're an FDN practitioner and find out that, well, this patient seems to be very sensitive to this radiation and you have clear signs. For example, someone gets a headache every time they are on a phone, or you can have some people have heart palpitations or tinnitus that are directly triggered by certain exposures where they know this is causality. They say, my God, I go by this machine and I feel that way. Well, these people need to mitigate things further in order to calm down their system. It's just like someone who is especially mold toxic that still lives in the moldy environment. It doesn't work. So in these more rare cases, hiring someone, a professional building biology consultant or EMF mitigation specialist, it's a great referral to consider in your practice also.
This is awesome, man. And I like the realistic approach to this. I don't think you're posing anything that's insane or too crazy. I mean, again, you really like are living up to the title, non-tinfoil hat, right? It's just, let's do what we can. I like what you said about the distance thing as well. I sound like I have more examples for EMFs than I actually do. I love light. So I'm studying the literal EMFs, right? The electromagnetic spectrum. You're studying a lot of the non-native EMFs. So one of the things that I've always brought up to people is, and it sucks because I hope people have a visual for this because I have a very clear one. There's a massive cell tower that's probably, I don't know, 10 miles from me, but it's, you can see it everywhere in our area. And I'm like, if I climbed this thing and just stood up there hugging the top of that, that wouldn't go too well. And it wouldn't take too long to realize it's not going too well.
Yeah.
But if I just stood at the bottom of that, I could probably camp out there for years and years before anything major happened. And that's crazy, but that's really just a couple hundred feet. But the distance does matter. So
it does.
If someone says, well, wait, Nick, is it really worth putting my phone on the desk versus in my pocket? Yeah, especially over 10, 20, 30 years, you have just greatly mitigated that cumulative effect. Every little bit counts here that we can do. And I think it is fair to say the sicker that one is, the more they might benefit from really going a little bit more extreme with the reduction of exposure. I noticed personally when I was sicker, this was a bigger issue for me. When I got my health more under control, I at least think I have a more balanced approach to this, and I seem to be able to handle more of this than was true in the past. So you talked about a course. We have your book. I'd love to know all the things that you do now and what you offer people. Because again, we have practitioners listening. We have people that are just sick on their health journey listening that might not want to be practitioners. I mean, it seems like you have something that could probably benefit both of those groups.
For sure. Yeah. The Electropollution Fix course is what I've co-created with Brian Hoyer, who's an EMF mitigation specialist in the US, and he has mitigated the homes of thousands of families. So we wanted the very, very practical approach to EMF mitigation, but also teach the average layperson, but also practitioners. Most practitioners appreciate the course also because it really helps them understand the difference between the EMF, like electric fields, the magnetic component, or radio frequency that is wireless. And there are different ways to identify these EMFs and different ways to mitigate against them because they act differently. So it can become overwhelming if you hear terms like dirty electricity. That's another subtype of EMF, and that's another discussion. And even the medical literature is not the same on all these different types of EMFs. So it can become complicated, but we try to, you know, sum it up, make it in bite-sized chunks, small videos, and also, you know, follow along sheets with action steps that can help you mitigate. So I think it's a very good summary. You can find it on my website, theemfguy.com. And I also have a summit coming up that is dedicated to electrosensitivity.
Okay.
The 2024 EMF Hazard Summit from April 11th to 14th.
Do you work with anyone one-on-one, or is everything that you offer kind of, you know, something that people can purchase or more educational at this point?
More educational. Yeah, I don't do consults, but my colleague Brian, who is the co-author of some of my materials, does consultations with his company Shielded Healing. That's his EMF mitigation company. And they, you know, they do consults for people that are electrosensitive and maybe they want to improve their environment, or they want a home survey, or even people that build new homes that want to mitigate against these things.
Awesome. Nick, actually, for the first time like ever, I have several more minutes than I was expecting, so I might just rapid fire some things I didn't get to come up with yet today.
Sure.
One of the biggest ones, and I'm sure there's got to be someone else out there listening either now or eventually that's thinking this. What do you think about these supposed EMF pendants or blankets? Or I've seen one of the craziest ones that I've seen, and I'm not sure if this is actually good. There are like these Faraday cages, more or less, that you can do as like kind of like netting for your bed. Now, the problem is it's shielding like everything, not just the non-native stuff. So that could probably offer its whole a whole slew of problems in and of itself. Like, is there any known validity to any of these things? I'm not saying that there is or isn't. I haven't done the research in that sense, but some of it seems rich to me that I can wear a necklace and all of a sudden I'm shielded from EMFs. That seems a little far out, but I don't know. So educate me.
Yeah, well, I think your intuition is right. You know, there's no magic bullet. Some of these devices claim to be able to reduce either the symptoms associated with EMF exposure for people that are hypersensitive or feel especially affected, or some of them claim straight up that you're completely protected from EMFs now, which I think is wildly inaccurate. I haven't seen a scientist really endorse those, but they have their time and place where some people that are hypersensitive and cannot cope with exposures that are, you know, societal, the neighbors' Wi-Fi and cell towers, they do seem to respond well to certain devices. There's a short list of different devices. I don't endorse any of them, but I've talked about some and I even interviewed some the owners of certain of these devices. And I think they have their validity in certain contexts, but they should be used with EMF mitigation strategies that we discussed and not as a replacement to these EMF mitigation strategies.
Excellent. All right. That makes a lot of sense to me. I was just wondering, I'd love for something to come up that is really that great.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't I? It's just, you know, anytime something seems so simple, it's like, all right, maybe there's a little bit more here that we got to check out. Okay, what do you think about grounding as a kind of mitigation tool for this? So what I mean by grounding, I mean literal human grounding, me go walking out, earthing, I should actually probably use that word,
yeah.
Walking out in the sand, in the grass, because I've heard controversy around this. Some people are like, well, if you're on the beach, you know, in a remote area, that's fine. But then I've heard things, and again, this is where I'm really getting to my area of ignorance. I've heard things like, well, if I'm grounded in a park in the middle of a city, I actually might be doing more harm than good. Can you enlighten us on that a little bit?
Yeah, well, you know, some people tend to be a little bit extreme about, you know, the pros and cons of certain things. Like, well, should you go outside in the sun and get your vitamin D, or should you avoid air pollution so therefore you stay inside in a bubble? It's difficult. Everything is a trade-off these days. So it's the same thing if you go grounding in a park. If you measurably or, let's say, subjectively feel worse doing it, maybe you're doing your earthing grounding in a park in Central Park, New York City, and underneath you is a high voltage power line and you don't know about it. And you feel horrible. You say, what is happening here? Or maybe you're doing it and there are pesticides everywhere, you know, and you feel sick to your stomach. Well, follow your intuition about this. But generally speaking, grounding / earthing is a great mitigation strategy, not necessarily kind of protecting you about EMFs, but a lot of people that feel EMF sensitivity swear by it. And they swear that, you know, it will calm down their nervous system. And it's logical because, you know, you're exposing yourself to natural frequencies. So we need more of those. We certainly don't get nearly enough of these natural frequencies and too much of the noise. So I think as a balancing act, getting in the sun, getting grounded, it's a great strategy.
Okay, awesome. Nick, thank you. You are an absolute wealth of information with this. There might be a round two in store, if that's okay, maybe several
sure.
months down the line.
Yeah, I'd be happy to.
Well, we'll talk off air. I have something for you real quick. So with that said, though, the signature question that we always have on the show, and if you're on the audio and can't see the video, I'm sorry, the emfguy.com is where to find Nick and all his stuff. The signature question that we have on the show is a general one about health, but you can answer in terms of EMF mitigation. It's completely fine. But the question I want to ask you is, if I could give you, Nick, a magic wand and you could wave it and get every single person in this world to do one thing for their health. So that means you can force us to start doing one thing, or you can force us to stop doing one thing. What is the one thing that Nick Pino gets us to do?
Jeez. Oh my God. It's tough. There are so many of them. I would say, you know, to save the largest amount of people from brain tumors, I would tell them the entire population, no cell phone to the head. And I think right there, I would save, I don't know what's the number, but thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions of people. And at least there's that, you know?
Yeah. Awesome. Nick, thank you so much for coming on, and we're looking forward to working with you in the future.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.